Here in the hills, every boulder, every fold of ground was a possible enemy readout and had to be minutely inspected before they could move on. Sean fretted with impatience, but forced himself to gear his advance to the difficult terrain. They turned the corner of another low hill, and through a frieze of graceful msasa trees, an open vista stretched ahead to where the massif of the central escarpment rose above its foothills. "There it is," Sean murmured. "That's where they'll be laying for us." The spoor was pointed directly at a pass through the escarpment. The entrance was guarded by cliffs of red stone, and the gut of the pass was almost devoid of trees or cover. And yet the sides were heavily bushed. It was a natural trap, a perfect killing ground. Metatu whistled in the centre, and Sean doubled over, keeping off the crest as he ran down to join him. From the centre there was an unimpeded view up the gut of the valley, and Sean saw movement against the scree and yellow grass. He lifted the binoculars to his eyes, and the line of dark moving specks resolved through the lens into a column of men. They were toiling up the incline in single file. Most of them wore tiger-striped camouflage and jungle hats, although a few were dressed in a motley of denim and khaki. The front of the column was already into the bush at the head of the valley, at least 3 miles distant. But through his binoculars, Sean counted 12 men. The litter was in the centre. 4 of them were carrying it. 2 men on the front poles and 2 on the back. Sean tried to pick out Claudia's form, but before he could refocus his binoculars, the litter and the bearers had reached the tree line and disappeared. Sean lowered his binoculars and polished the lens with his handkerchief. Pumula had come in from the other flank, and now he and Metatu crouched in the jumble of rock and coarse bush and studied the lie of the land in gloomy silence. Again Sean raised the glasses and studied the steep bushy sides. It was a perfect sight for an ambush. They could catch Sean's party in enfilade and crossfire as they tried to climb the valley. "How many did you see?" Sean asked without lowering his binoculars. "Have they all gone into the trees at the head of the valley?" "I saw only a few," Pumula murmured. "Masesh!" Metatu spat unhappily. He was referring to the lease of the millet beer that after fermentation the Batonga fishermen used as a ground bait to lure the shoals of bream into the Lake Kariba shallows. He spat again. "That valley is the mouth of the crocodile. They want us to put our heads into it." Sean studied the sides of the valley, taking his time, every few minutes lowering the binoculars to rest his eyes and then lifting them again. He began at the top of the slope and swept gradually downwards. When he reached the bottom, he began at the top again, going over the same ground time and time again. He tried not to think of that sighting of the litter, or the tiny figure he thought he had seen upon it. He concentrated entirely on his search, and 10 minutes later he was rewarded. It was a single flash of sunlight, reflected from the lens of a wristwatch or the lens of a pair of field glasses. "There they are." He lowered his own glasses. "Yes, Metatu, you are right. They put out the bait. Now they are waiting for us." He sat down behind the boulder and tried to think it through logically. But Claudia's memory kept intruding and deflecting his reasoning. There was only one certain conclusion, and that was that it was hopeless to continue the pursuit. He looked up. Metatu and Pumula were watching him with expressions of blind faith. In almost 20 years they had never seen him at a loss. They waited patiently for him to perform the miracle yet again. Sean found it infuriating. He jumped up and went back down the hill to think, without those trusting eyes upon him. He found a spot that was well concealed, and yet had a good all-round view so that nobody could sneak up on him, and he settled down with a .577 across his lap to consider his options. The first one he crossed from his mental list was an attack on the Renamo column. Even leaving aside the puny forces he had available, he had to consider the hostages that Renamo had in their hands. Even with a company of fully armed scouts, he would still have been unable to attack. So what can I hope to achieve by following them? He asked himself, apart from gratifying this new and mawkish desire to be as close as possible to Claudia Montero. Probably the best chance of release of the captives from Renamo clutches was not his own intervention, but diplomatic negotiations through Renamo's reputed allies, the South African government in Pretoria. However, even the South Africans would not be able to achieve anything if they were unaware that an American citizen had been captured by Renamo. Okay, Sean made his first firm decision. I have to get a message back to the American embassy in Harare. Immediately he realized that this took care of his other major worry. Matatu and Pumula were his responsibility. Up to now he had been leading them into a suicidal situation. They had been more and more on his conscience the closer they drew to the Renamo column. This was the excuse he'd been looking for. I'll send both of them back to Chiwewe with a message for Rima. He opened the flap of his backpack and found his small, leather-covered notepad. He began to compose the message. Rima had all Ricardo's and Claudia's personal details on the safari files, everything from their physical descriptions to their passport numbers. Ricardo was an important and influential man. Sean would not tell her that he was dead, but implied in his message that both father and daughter were captives of Renamo. The U.S. Embassy could be relied on to act swiftly, and he would be in contact with Pretoria within hours of receiving the news. Of course, since the imposition of U.S. sanctions on that country, the relations between Washington and Pretoria were at a historically low ebb, and the influence of the U.S. in southern Africa was no longer the overriding factor that it had once been. Nonetheless, the South Africans would be relied on to intercede with Renamo on the simplest humanitarian grounds. Okay, that takes care of Matatu and Pumula. Sean signed the message, tore the pages out of his notepad and folded them. Then, as an afterthought, he filled another page of instructions for Rima, covering the $500,000 that Ricardo's estate owed him. She was to pass these on to Sean's lawyer. Then, at last, he had to make his own decision. He could run back across the border, carrying the message himself, and within 2 or 3 days he could be drinking Castle Lager in the Meeklis Hotel and working out how to spend Capo's $500,000. That was the sensible and logical thing to do, but he'd already dismissed the idea before he considered it. So, I'll follow the column and wait for an opportunity. He grinned at the absurdity of his decision. What opportunity? He wondered at himself. A chance to shoot my way into an encampment of 50-plus Turs with the old .577, free the 3 prisoners, and with one mighty bound, whip them 100 miles to the border, carrying Claudia with her injured leg on my back. He stood up and resettled his pack between his shoulders and crept back up to the slope where Matatu and Pumula were lying watching the escarpment. He dropped down beside Matatu. Anything? He asked, and Matatu shook his head. They were silent for many minutes while Sean plucked up his courage to tell the little man he was sending him back. While he did so, he scowled through the binoculars at the spot up the long valley where he knew Renamo had set their ambush. Matatu seemed to sense that something unpleasant was brewing. He kept glancing at Sean with a troubled expression. But when Sean finally turned to him, he burst into a sunny, ingratiating grin and wriggled his entire body in his eagerness to please and to stave off whatever was coming. "I remember," he said eagerly. "I remember who he is." Sidetracked for the moment, Sean frowned at him in puzzlement.
"Who? Who are you talking about?"
"The leader of the Renamo," Matatu told him happily. "I told you yesterday I knew his footprints. Now I remember who he is."
"Who is he then?"
Sean asked suspiciously, ready to reject the information.
"Do you remember when we jumped from the Indeki to attack the training camp at the fork of the rivers?"
Matatu twinkled at him, and Sean nodded guardedly.
"Do you remember how we killed them in the riverbed?"
Matatu chuckled with a delightful memory of it.
"Do you remember the one we caught while he was trying to burn the books? The one who refused to march, and you blew his ear in?
Now he giggled at that fine joke.
The blood came out of his ear hole and he squeaked like a virgin.
Comrade China?
China!
Matatu had a little difficulty with the pronunciation.
Yes, that is the one.
No, Sean shook his head. It isn't China. That's not possible. Now Matatu had to cover his mouth to muffle his delighted squeals of laughter. He loved it when he was able to confound and astound his master. There was no better joke than that.
China!
He spluttered with mirth and struck his forefinger in his own ear.
Pow!
He said, and it was so funny he almost choked.
Comrade China!
Sean stared at him unseeingly while he adjusted his mind to this extraordinary intelligence. All his instincts were to reject it out of hand, but Matatu didn't make mistakes of that nature. Comrade China, Sean breathed softly. That changes the odds a little. He cast his mind back to that distant day. The man had made such an impression upon him that even from the crowded and confused events of that bloody little war, he retrieved a clear image of Comrade China. He remembered his fine nilotic head and the dark, intelligent eyes. But his physical characteristics were hazy compared to Sean's memory of the sense of confidence and purpose that the man exuded. He'd been a dangerous man then, and Sean expected that now he would be even more experienced and formidable. Sean shook his head. At one time, his nickname in the scouts had been Lucky Courtney. It looked as though he had used up his ration of that commodity. He couldn't have chosen anybody he would have wanted less to command the column of Renamo than Comrade China. Matatu had almost exhausted his mirth and was now battling with the hiccups that followed, clutching at his naked belly and throat to hold them down, while occasional spasms of laughter interspersed the loud hiccups. "I'm sending you back to Chiwewe," Sean told him harshly. And the laughter and hiccups were instantly extinguished. Matatu stared at him in disbelief and utter despair. Sean could not face those eyes and their tragic accusation. He turned to Pumula and brusquely called him across to where he lay. "This note is for the chef at camp. Tell him to radio the message to Miss Rima in Harare. Matatu will guide you back. Don't stop to pick your nose on the way. Do you understand me?" "Mambo." Pumula was an old scout. He would obey without argument or question. "All right, go," Sean ordered. "Go now." And Pumula held out his right hand. They shook hands the African way, gripping palms and then thumbs and then palms again. Pumula crawled down off the ridge, and once he was clear, jumped to his feet and trotted away. He did not look back. At last, Sean forced himself to look at Matatu. He crouched low to the ground, trying to make his small frame smaller still to escape Sean's notice. "Go," Sean ordered brusquely. "Show Pumula the way back to Chiwewe." Matatu hung his head and shivered like a whipped puppy. "Get the hell out of here," Sean growled at him, "before I kick your black butt." Matatu lifted his head and his eyes were tragic, his expression abject. Sean wanted to pick him up and hug him. "Get out of here, you stupid little bugger." Sean made a face of terrifying ferocity, and Matatu crept away a few paces and then paused and looked back imploringly. "Go!" Sean lifted his right hand threateningly. At last the little man accepted the inevitable and slunk away down the slope. Just before he disappeared into the coarse scrub at the foot of the slope, he paused and looked back one more time, seeking just one faintest sign of encouragement or weakness. He was the epitome of dejection. Deliberately, Sean turned his back on him and raised the binoculars to study the terrain ahead. But after a few seconds, the image blurred and he blinked his eyes to clear them, and despite himself, glanced quickly over his shoulder. Matatu had vanished. It was a strange feeling not to have him there. After a few minutes, Sean lifted the binoculars again and resumed his study of the escarpment line, pushing Matatu out of his mind.